Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Lois Morford, known among friends and admirers as an international activist, died last month. She had lived in Astoria for many years. She was a teacher and spent considerable time in Central America doing humanitarian work for victims of despotic governments supported and quite often subordinated by the United States. She was a United Nations observer at a refugee camp in Honduras filled with refugees who had fled repression and death squads in El Salvador and Guatemala. She was also a member of a delegation from Oregon sent to Nicaragua as part of the Witness for Peace program, sponsored by clergy and laity concerned, threatened several times by attack from U.S.-supported Contra guerrillas. She returned to Honduras and Guatemala many times and wrote several articles about Central America for various publications, including the North Coast Times Eagle. On the cusp of this new millennium, she attended a huge demonstration against the World Trade Association's meeting in Seattle in late 1999, which she wrote about for the Times Eagle, which I will read on today's program. And I will also read an article she wrote for the Times Eagle about an ancestor who won the Medal of Honor during the Civil War, which was illustrated by Astoria artist Roger Hayes. Seattle, 1999, by Lois Morford. I participated for 6 days in the protest against the World Trade Organization in Seattle, and I would like to share some of my experiences with you. Please remember I was only one among many thousands and saw only a few of the events taking place. I arrived on Sunday, November 28, 1999, and connected with my friend Ruth Sheridan, age 81, who had flown down from Anchorage to meet me. We had previously done social justice work together in the refugee camps in Central America. Our first stop was the warehouse that Direct Action Network had rented, which I learned of from NPR while driving up. Many young people were congregated outside, some on stilts or making parade puppets and signs. The lobby walls were covered with posters and large maps of Seattle, indicating march routes and times. Literature tables circled the room with information from many labor, environmental, and international groups about the WTO. We signed in, and the first question was, "Have you had nonviolence training?" In a back room draped with black plastic for darkness, several people slept. Food was available for the hungry: rice, beans, tofu, veggies, bread. Directions were posted for bus or car transport to a place for protesters to stay for $10 a night. In another room, people were role-playing in their nonviolence and consensus decision-making training. The place was buzzing with high energy and organization. Our next stop was an afternoon session at Plymouth Congregational Church featuring prominent U.S. and Canadian disarmament groups on WTO and the global war system, which explained how the World Trade Organization drives the arms race and uses military power to defend corporate interests around the world. There was standing room only. We had to squeeze in. An enthusiastic crowd gave standing ovations after almost every presentation, which became standard for the week. We reached our next event half an hour early, but it was already packed. It was an ecumenical worship and prayer service at St. James Cathedral, focusing on Jubilee 2000, part of a worldwide movement to cancel the crushing debt owed by the poorest countries in the world. Jim Wallace of Sojourners Magazine gave the sermon. The Bible verse was Leviticus 25. A compelling event we could have attended was at the Museum of Science and Industry, a welcoming for activists called Celebrate and Resist, featuring reggae, hip-hop, hardcore, and subversive theater. Activists free, all others $10. On Monday, Ruth and I attended another packed forum at the Methodist Church on environmental and health issues of the WTO. At noon, as part of the Seattle Tea Party, not to be confused with the later right-wing Republican Tea Party, we all marched to the convention center to hear speakers on a variety of environmental and animal issues. At dusk, we attended an interfaith gathering and rally in support of Jubilee 2000, followed by a march to link the arms of 10,000 people around the convention center. The interfaith service was like nothing I have ever experienced. The prayers were from Native Americans with drumming and singing, a rabbi blowing a ram's horn, a Unitarian, a Muslim reading from the Quran about justice, a Buddhist who had a stand, breathe om and chant, a Hindu with a prayer service, a bowing with candles, and finally a Christian, a tiny, energetic Asian woman who urged us on. Sweet Honey in the Rock sang for us. George Sweeney, president of the AFL-CIO, introduced Maxine Waters from California, who gave a rousing speech. The church was packed. Hundreds more watched on video downstairs and outside, and thousands waited on the street for us to finish. Then, 10,000 strong, we marched to nonviolently link arms around the convention center. The organizers calculated it would take 10,000 to complete the circle, as the police had erected rent-a-fences several blocks away. We not only completed the circle, in some places we were more than 2 and 3 deep. It was raining, and we chanted, "We're cold, we're wet, cancel the debt," and "Feed the needy, not the greedy," as well as the standard, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, the WTO has got to go." On a signal, we all released our arms, symbolizing breaking the chain of debt. It was a powerful experience. What to do now? 100 or so of us walked around to try to get a little closer to the convention center. We found a place where we could look through the rent-a-fence to see the delegates arriving in their stretch limousines and formal attire for the opening dinner about 2 blocks away. Seeing us arrive, the police responded. A row of 15 or so, looking like spacemen in their new SWAT gear, came to face us across the flimsy fence. It was sort of a Keystone Cops maneuver. They planned to march out, then turn in a jump to face us with their weapons. But they had not rehearsed enough. Some jumped one way, some the other, some not at all. They looked at each other in confusion. Soon they were reinforced by contingents of police on motorcycles, on bicycles, on horses, and even in an armored vehicle, which faced us off. We began chanting to them, as far-off delegates could not hear us. "Protect the needy, not the greedy. Turn the other way." They were facing us, with the WTO behind them. "We won't pay your overtime." And finally, "We like your boots." That made some of them smile. The feeling was lighthearted. Both protesters and police were completely disciplined. Then we all broke off and left to find a way home. This was a completely nonviolent, prayerful march of over 10,000 people. Did you hear anything about that? The next day, Tuesday, was the humongous labor march for fair trade. Ruth and I bussed to Memorial Stadium by the Space Needle to join 30,000 mostly unionists in a rally, then a 4-mile march to downtown. Other marches were forming in other areas of the city, 20,000 here, 10,000 there. In all, there must have been about 80,000 of us protesting in Seattle on Tuesday, including the thousands who did not march but were forming human barricades around the convention center and the hotels where the WTO delegates were staying. The march was amazing. Many thousands marched with their unions, such as steelworkers, electricians, public employees, the ILWU, which shut down all West Coast ports for the day, and many, many more. Many passed out literature about their causes to other marchers. Many single interest groups were there. An animal rights activist with a beautiful 3D butterfly on a pole stating, "The WTO kills butterflies. Genetically engineered corn kills monarch butterflies." A woman with a sign adorned with kale, cabbage, and broccoli, "Support small farmers, buy from farmers' markets." A woman with a sign taped on her back, "End the daily U.S. bombing of Iraq." During the march, everyone was talking together, exchanging information, forming alliances. Ruth and I, after a mile or so, would sit out for a while and watch 3 or 4 blocks of protesters march by, then join in with a new interesting group. For several blocks, we marched with French unionists chanting in French, all together, hey, hey. The march seemed endless. I have never participated in such a large protest, and neither had Ruth in all her 81 years. It was thrilling for us both. We heard a rumor that after the march, there was to be a spontaneous protest at the downtown McDonald's. I would have preferred to protest at their corporate headquarters, but we went to see what was happening. There was a large crowd of noisy, peaceful protesters. McDonald's had two plastic banners strung up. One said, Sundays and Wednesdays, two burgers, two fries, $2. The protesters pulled that banner down to many cheers. The other said, now hiring. I watched a young man climb on the shoulders of another, expecting him to tear it down. Instead, he pulled out a pen and wrote, slaves. So the sign now said, now hiring, slaves. The crowd cheered. The French Roquefort cheese farmers were there. When the European Union refused to accept hormone-raised beef from the United States, the WTO fined them and applied sanctions, specifically against Roquefort cheese by name. The farmers were irate and were taking the WTO head-on. One had driven his tractor through a McDonald's in France. They set up a table outside the McDonald's in Seattle and were passing out Roquefort cheese and crackers to all the protesters. The cows say no, we chanted. The cheese was delicious. Then several hoodlums arrived, dressed all in black with black masks and sticks, and started beating the window. No one knew who they were. We were all shocked. People shouted, no violence, and hey, cool it. But they trashed the window and ran away. I got a good close-up picture of them and was surprised they didn't harm my camera. This was the only incident of violence or vandalism I personally witnessed during my 6 days in Seattle. We next encountered a barricade of protesters at the Roosevelt Hotel, barring the entrance to WTO delegates. They had been there all day while the march had passed around them and were deciding whether to let two reporters from France through their barricade. I was very impressed with the democratic process. The bullhorn was passed around and everyone had a chance to speak until consensus was achieved. I heard later that the police were instructed to arrest leaders, but with this kind of decision-making, there were no leaders. When we finally made it to our hostel Tuesday night, we were invigorated, feeling the protest had been phenomenally successful. But Wednesday was a shocker. We awoke to the TV news that the mayor had declared a no-protest zone over downtown Seattle. At that moment, protesters outside the zone were being arrested and tear-gassed, and the zone had just been extended to include their area. The violence and vandalism and confrontations between protesters and police the night before were shown over and over on television. The buses weren't running. People were asked to stay home. Ruth and I managed to make it to the Methodist Church Forum, which was on how the WTO impacts democracy, development, and the lives of women. We heard powerful, angry, articulate women from all over the world, Tanzania, Mexico, Philippines, St. Lucia, Malaysia, Africa, El Salvador, Canada. A women's African drumming group energized us, and the Raging Grannies and street theater entertained us. Ralph Nader addressed us. We had permits for a legal, nonviolent march at noon, and the consensus was we should go, even if we faced tear gas and arrest. The church people negotiated with the city, and we got permission to go if we absolutely went single file on the sidewalk with no signs and no chants, and we're not threatening. So about 1,000 of us taped our mouths, held hands, and walked in silence to face a line of SWAT team-dressed police with helmets, pads, and weapons. It felt very powerful. After a while, we hummed, "We shall overcome," then returned to the church. Seattle on Wednesday reminded me of Central America during the violence of the 1980s. Police were everywhere, and many intersections were blocked by police or protesters, sometimes both. A month before Christmas, there were few others and no shoppers. Many stores were boarded up. Tear gas protesters sought shelter in the church, and one man from Global Exchange was hit in the face by a rubber bullet, which penetrated his lower lip and knocked out some teeth. During the afternoon session, we were asked to remain in the church because of tear gas outside and an impending curfew. The basement of the church had one room with literature tables, and just about every peace, justice, environmental, and faith-based group I have ever heard of, plus many unions, were distributing literature and networking. Jim Hightower, in his cowboy hat, broadcast 2 hours of radio every morning from the church basement. As the tear gas protesters arrived during the afternoon, we congregated there and formed many alliances. We realized even more how all our issues meshed and felt our solidarity. The steelworkers have formed an alliance with the street tree sitters in Northern California, and they invited everyone to a free party at the church. David Brower, president of the steelworkers, and David Foster of Earth Island Institute spoke of their alliance and their hope of bringing union members and environmentalists together in a massive movement. There was a wonderful alliance of foods, everything from turkey, baked potatoes, and hearty soup for the steelworkers, to hummus, tabbouleh, veggies, fruit, and chips for the vegetarians. Everyone feasted, picked up literature, shared stories from the streets. Charlie King, Jim Page, Sweet Honey in the Rock, and African drumming entertained us. The sanctuary was rocking. By the time Ruth and I left, the curfew was on, many streets barricaded, and the buses not running. The raging grannies tore up sheets to make armbands for us to show we were peaceful protesters. Fortunately, we were able to sneak out of the church, circumvent the barricades, and walk up over First Hill to where we were staying without encountering tear gas. Ruth is a member of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, WILF. And they were one of the NGOs, non-governmental, non-profit organizations, who had been invited to attend the WTO meetings. We went to debriefings every evening to learn what was going on. These powerful, informed women, one from the U.S. and one from Canada, had attended other international meetings where they also met in women's caucuses to decide strategy and lobbied their own country's delegates. But at this WTO, they felt completely marginalized, more like window dressing than players. They were given abbreviated packets that did not even include agendas or locations of meetings. They were served elaborate lunches and given a box of chocolates, but had no access to delegates. They reported that delegates of smaller nations felt equally marginalized and powerless. The golden rule of the WTO seemed to be the ones with the gold make the rules. Thursday's session at the church was on food and agriculture, again with powerful speakers from around the globe, including India, Bangladesh, France, Uruguay, Korea, and China. They told us how the WTO requirement for exports is pushing hundreds of thousands of small farmers off the land and into cities, and of problems with genetically engineered crops. At noon, we marched down to Pike Street Market for a rally in support of family farmers. As we were returning to the church, we ran across a protest at the jail demanding the release of the Seattle 400 who had been arrested. The Direct Action Network was so disciplined. One guy juggled, another hula hooped, the crowd chanting but calm. Some of the chants were call and response. I was across the street and couldn't understand the words, but it sounded like a church service. The police surrounded the block but did not interfere. One man threw a bottle. Other protesters immediately picked up the broken glass. A man behind me yelled, "Agent Provocateur, will someone please escort that gentleman away?" He split. The protesters had too much nonviolence training to be incited into mob action. That evening, after our debriefing with WILF, Ruth and I walked up Capitol Hill to the community college where a video of police violence was scheduled. However, the college was closed because during the previous evening, students had been tear gassed as they left their classes. The students and neighbors were irate and were forming an impromptu march, as much to protest the police action as the WTO. We marched with them for a while, then turned off for the hostel and to bed. Friday's session was at the Lutheran Church and was on corporate accountability. We broke up a little early to join a march from the Labor Temple sponsored by Seattle's labor, environmental, religious, civic, community, and student groups. This was a huge march, larger than anyone expected, and was joined by many, many Seattleites protesting the police actions. We chanted, "This is what democracy looks like," and "Free the Seattle 400. One man had a large sign stating the First Amendment. Another said, "My taxes paid for your tear gas." Again, people were talking and networking all along the route. Two underground newspapers with news of the WTO protests not found in the local mainstream media were distributed. The American Civil Liberties Union passed out flyers asking for reports of police misconduct. The Wobblies, industrial workers of the world, called for a general strike. Everyone was talking about, where do we go from here? How can we expand these alliances, and how can the movement grow? How can we spread the word about this powerful event in the face of the mainstream media's obsession with the violence? I wish I could have attended Friday's session on fisheries, aquaculture, and the WTO, where family fishers from around the world discussed the impact of globalization and corporate consolidation on their lives, environment, and community. But Ruth and I left on the 5 o'clock train after 6 very powerful and energizing days. I have been thinking about that week ever since, and I do have some observations and questions to throw out. 1. The protest I saw and experienced was nothing like what TV reported. Is this because TV is increasingly controlled and censored by big corporations? What can we do about it? Could we broadcast the church sessions, the peaceful marches on TV, or the internet? I was overjoyed, 2, to observe the young people in this protest. In their numbers, their friendliness, their discipline, their practice of nonviolence and use of consensus. One young man asked me if this was what it was like in the 60s, or were we a lot more organized? I had to laugh. 3, the police were protecting the WTO, not the citizens or businesses of Seattle. Their orders were to maintain their perimeters, and they did nothing to stop the window breakers, even though they were right there. They were much less organized than the protesters. 4, it was wonderful to share the protest with the unions and the developing alliance between them, the environmentalists and the church, is portentous. We all felt it. 5, unlike during the Vietnam War protests, there was little opposition to our views. Many people were frustrated by the shutdown of the city and the tear gas, but most thanked us for our work and said they agreed with us 100%. And 6, what should we do about the rock throwers? Some of us thought we should control them ourselves, as they destroyed our message. Others said, no, we are peaceful protesters. It is up to the police to control the violence. What did the mass nonviolent movements of Gandhi and Martin Luther King do about rock throwers? Does anybody know? All 4 of my children have told me they are proud I was protesting in Seattle, and my teenage granddaughter asked me to take her with me if I ever went to another protest. It was difficult for her 5-year-old sister, watching TV and knowing her grandmother was there, to figure out who were the good guys and who were the bad guys. Their mother suggested that part of the fervor was millennium fever, and she's probably right, as the corporations have been overly greedy for a long time. But I say, let's build on it. This week felt like the beginning of a new mass international social movement. Folks, I think a question in the future will be, were you in Seattle in 1999? I am so happy that I was. And that was Seattle 1999 by Lois Morford. And again, now by Lois Morford, Post-Civil War Disorder. In the 1950s, as a 20-year-old expectant mother, I met my husband's great-aunt Lola, who was in her 90s. We formed a bond as we both propped up our swollen ankles. I greatly admired a framed photograph on her wall, showing her as a child standing with her family in front of their sod house in Kansas about 1880. Her father, Jerome Morford, wears the Congressional Medal of Honor he won in the Civil War. She and her mother wear their Sunday best, hats and shoes. My husband's great-grandfather, William, sits on the wagon seat, showing off the horses. The younger children are barefoot. The Kansas prairie is empty in the distance. Eventually, Aunt Lola gave me her framed photo. It hangs on my bedroom wall, and I look at it often. Jerome Morford was a 20-year-old farm boy when he enlisted in the Illinois 55th Infantry Regiment in 1861. In their first battle at Shiloh in April 1862, one officer and 51 men were killed, nine officers and 190 men wounded, and 26 men captured. He fought in at least 35 additional battles, including Sherman's March to the Sea, and was mustered out in 1865. The Congressional Medal of Honor was for action on May 22, 1863. Jerome volunteered for Forlorn Hope, the additional assault by 150 volunteers on Vicksburg. Their task was to build a bridge across the ditch at the foot of the city walls and place scaling ladders for a general assault. Only unmarried men were allowed to volunteer as, quote, there was little possibility of any of them returning alive, unquote, read his citation. It was a debacle. Those few who made it running across 80 yards of enemy fire, carrying their lumber and ladders to the ditch below the city walls, could do nothing but hunker down and endure constant shelling from 8 a.m. until dark. The bottom of the ditch was strewn with mangled bodies, with heads and limbs blown off. 85% of the volunteers were killed or severely wounded. The remainder, including Jerome Morford, received the Medal of Honor for, quote, superb gallantry and reckless indifference to death and danger, the account cited. There is nothing in military history to excel the conduct of Forlorn Hope that led the general assault on Vicksburg May 22, 1863, quote, unquote. Jerome was damaged by the war. We call it post-traumatic stress syndrome. I don't know if it had a label after the terribly traumatic Civil War. Jerome suffered. He withdrew. He was violent and abusive to his family. He constantly moved his family west. If he could see the smoke from a neighbor's chimney, it was time to move on. The photo with the sod hut was taken in Kansas on his way away. He died in Seattle in 1910. I have been told where he subsequently lived on the way, and the names and birthdays of his children could be documented from his pension records. But Jerome never received his pension. He just fled. Unfortunately, the war and his legacy lived on. His violence and abuse descended through the generations, as it often does, to affect even my own children, his great-great-grandchildren. It breaks my heart. There are more victims of war than those who are killed. And that was Post-Civil War Disorder by Lois Morford. The Civil War ostensibly ended 3 days from today, on April 9, 1865. And 52 years later, 100 years ago today, on April 6, 1917, the United States entered World War I with a declaration of war announced by President Woodrow Wilson following a resolution by the House of Representatives. The Senate passed a similar resolution 3 days earlier on April 3rd. Among 50 dissenters in the House was Montana's Congresswoman, Jeanette Rankin, who was the first woman elected to Congress. 24 years later, she became the only member of Congress to vote against both world wars when she cast the single dissenting vote to war with Japan on December 8, 1942, the day after Pearl Harbor. As a woman, I can't go to war, and I refuse to send anyone else, she said. She had just begun her second term in the House after a two-decade absence, which was the case with her first term in 1917, just after being officially recognized as the nation's first congresswoman. She led the Jeanette Rankin Brigade of 5,000 in a protest march against the Vietnam War in Washington, D.C. in 1968. She died in 1973, aged 93. So it might be wise to think of these two notable women, Lois Morford and Jeanette Rankin, as useful illuminations not only in memory, but as resistance to the darkening future in which Donald Trump willfully dismantles democracy and shatters the always fragile compact of civility. And the missiles of North Korea reach ever closer from across the Pacific. This has been Michael McCusker.